Hello and welcome to End All Shall Be Well. My name is Megan Rohr and I am your host. Today I am talking to Edward Wright, who is a passionate advocate in San Francisco who works on transportation issues and has been someone who is always on the side of those who are in need of justice. And our conversation is not only about some of the work that they're doing in the world, but about some of the ways that they try to stay well in these times, particularly when there are political divisions in the world and when people might be having opinions that affect them or their family. This conversation is one that brings me hope and has really centered on joy, and I believe might help you make it through a day like today.
My name is Edward Wright. My pronouns are he and him. I've worked as an organizer, as an activist. I've worked at a nonprofit for a labor union. I've worked on campaigns and for political organizations and in government. I've helped write and pass laws. And most recently, I have focused my career on public transit. And for today, I think I should also say I'm a friend and admirer of yours.
That's nice. I'll take it. Are there particular intersections about yourself that you want to also add to the kaleidoscope of who you are so people kind of get a picture?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm a queer cisgender man, and I think my queerness is like super important to me, not only in terms of my identity, but in terms of kind of how my work has been shaped and how I think about it. I think it's the first thing that sort of gave me permission to let go of rules and expectations. Because, you know, growing up in suburban Michigan, there are a lot of expectations that are placed on you about how you might be or how you might walk through the world. And I think coming to terms with being queer was kind of my entryway into saying that, oh, if all of these things are made up, what else is just sort of made up that we kind of have the freedom to operate, you know, around or outside of. So yeah, I think my queerness is super central to my identity and giving me an understanding of, you know, freedom and liberation and how that's built on the backs of generations of people fighting in social movements, fighting in civil movements, fighting for freedom. And that's very much a lineage I try to embody that informs how I see the world. And it's also a lineage that's like super connected with other struggles for liberation. The women's movement, Black and Brown liberation, the labor movement, all of those are like deeply interconnected with the movement for queer liberation. And then I think, you know, being cisgender and being a man, those are ways that I'm very privileged as a queer person. And so then the question I try to ask myself is, how can I use that privilege for that broader struggle or those interconnected struggles? And then I think aside from that, I'm a renter. I'm a union member. I'm part of the largest shared identity group in the world, which is the working class, by which I mean my income, the means by which, you know, I live and eat and access comfort comes from me doing things, as opposed to me owning things. It comes from my labor. And I think being someone who, you know, works for a paycheck, being a part of the working class gives you a very different way of experiencing the world than if your income comes from owning property or capital. And I think, you know, in addition to that, I'm a public servant, which means I don't work for private interests or private profit. I work for the people of San Francisco. So the people pay my salary and I work for their interests. And that is a privilege and a responsibility that I take really, really seriously.
And I've known you in lots of different spaces, spaces with bullhorns, spaces with marching. We both work together on the Women's March in San Francisco, speaking of being involved in intersectional out there stuff to kind of support rights for folk. For those who might not live in a big space like San Francisco, when you talk about working in public transit, what is it that you mean?
Well, my job is primarily storytelling. So I'm a strategic communications advisor for SFMTA focused on transit. So we have various transit systems in the Bay Area. The one I work for is Muni, so the public transit system here in San Francisco. And my job, I think of it as just sort of affirmatively telling the story of public transit, and that, you know, when we invest in public transit, when we support public transit, we are supporting economic mobility, we're supporting climate action, we're supporting social equity and social justice, and we're supporting the economic recovery of San Francisco. So that's what I focus on in you know, my day job and my day-to-day life.
I've known you to be someone who helps and cares very much about allowing there to be bicycle access in a lot of spaces. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember some twittering in the midst of the COVID times to try to help there be streets that where people can walk and ride and be out in the world, especially during the time when here in San Francisco we were all kind of stuck at home and there was little reason to use our cars because we were mostly at home, to kind of make streets and open spaces more accessible for people and thinking about people-centric stuff rather than wheel-centric stuff, which sometimes kind of drives our way of being in the city. Is that true? I saw you touch your heart when you were talking about bicycles.
I literally have a sign from the Great Highway Park behind me. which is a public project I worked on that I'm really, really proud of. Also probably still processing some trauma because it was very controversial. But San Francisco did a really cool thing during the pandemic where we converted a coastal highway into a park or a promenade for people of all ages, all abilities to be able to get out and enjoy some fresh air and recreate. And I have literally seen hundreds of kids learn how to ride a bike for the first time on the Great Highway since then. And that has just been so heartwarming and important and cool, and is something I care really deeply about. And I think, you know, too often conversations about streets and about transportation sort of devolve into almost like a proxy culture war. You know, in American life, the car is a huge symbol. It's not just a tool, but it's like a symbol and people feel very strongly about it. And, you know, the way I try to approach my work is thinking about it in terms of giving people options. It's not about taking cars away from people. It's about giving people the freedom to make other choices if they want to. And it's making those choices, you know, compelling and safe and accessible and joyful, because you cannot tell me that riding a bike on a closed to cars highway along the coast, looking out at the beautiful Pacific Ocean is not joyful. It really, really is. And that's important.
Yeah. And I, growing up in South Dakota, I understand that when you live in a space where everything is very far apart, having a car is sometimes your life bridge to different spaces. Like you wouldn't be able to go to work. You wouldn't be able to see your family if you didn't have those kind of transportation spaces. Here in San Francisco, where the buildings are literally so close together, you can't see between them. We lived in a space that didn't have a backyard, but we lived four blocks away from the Great Highway. And so it's like giving a group of people who don't have a backyard for kids to play in something like a backyard. Like backyards in the Midwest are definitely not highways that are closed down on the weekends or near sand dunes, but it's a different kind of way of thinking about shared public space as opposed to just having private spaces in the back. Because here especially, I think there are different social economic levels that get to have access to backyard spaces. Or front yard spaces, even. There's the only parts of San Francisco that have front yards are the very mega wealthy parts of San Francisco. And I remember a few maybe 10 years ago now, I ran a project for Project Homeless Connect where we simply took an old parking lot and we made it into a community garden, because none of the spaces where homeless people live have backyards or have give you access to gardening space. And so to even just take these very narrow corridors and transform them into what used to be a highway and into kind of these shared garden spaces was a way to give people back parts of wellness that other people can take for granted, like going out and gardening at different parts of the year and doing things like that. So yeah. I definitely see that kind of work as wellness providing in the midst of COVID, where we all were like stuck inside and had no spaces away from those we dearly love, but also were irritated by at points, not you, but other people. Like having access to those spaces, I think helped give people a release valve that they kind of desperately needed. And whether or not it's someone's favorite road to get them to the Home Depot or not is a whole nother story in a community argument about it. But I think there's something really beautiful about being able to give people of all economic levels access to some of those spaces.
Absolutely. And I mean, the argument we made when we first closed the road was about social distancing early in the pandemic and the fact that many sidewalks in the city literally were not wide enough for people to maintain the, at that time, you know, required amount of distance from one another if they wanted to get out and walk around. The reason we kept it closed was not about physical health. It was about mental health. It was that so many people like found community and found respite and found, you know, access to nature and access to, you know, physical activity. And a lot of people would say, well, you know, it's right by the beach. Why can't you go do that on the beach? Not everyone is able to access those kinds of activities on sand, right? If you're someone who uses a wheelchair, if you're, you know, someone who uses a mobility device, that actually isn't accessible to you. And by virtue of having this paved space that benefits from those beautiful surroundings, that was made accessible to a lot more people. So it really was the mental health component of that made it stick, and why the Great Highway is still closed to vehicles on weekends and holidays to this day.
Well, good job. You did a thing. And I also think that, like, if you're used to learning how to ride a bicycle on a sidewalk, living in a city where it's against the law to ride a bicycle on the sidewalk so you don't injure pedestrians, makes it much harder for a small child to learn how to ride a bike. And so
yeah,
I'm grateful that my kids, as they were growing up, have some spaces where they could learn. They literally have to learn all the rules of the road in order to ride their bicycle on a regular street, and to be able to practice. Great Highway, for all everyone who hasn't been there before, still has like the lights that go yellow, green, and red, because during the week cars use the space, and then on the weekend it's close to cars. And so my kids could like literally practice, how do we stop at the red light? How do we like signal? How do we do all of these things? So they're practicing riding on a road because they're on a road, but without having to do it with cars. It's just like the number of times my kids would have died if they had not had a safe space like that to be able to work it all out is pretty clear to me. And so it is really a lovely thing that has been able to kind of create community and be a lovely space. And it's sort of also a testament to compromise. Like, we don't hear about compromise a lot in government. I don't know if you've read about this, but sometimes people want it just all my way or all the exact opposite way, and there's no spaces in between. And though it's not the best of every world for everyone, this idea that you can have the road closed on the weekend but then open during the week so that kind of both groups get a little bit of their say is sort of a testament to, like, we can pick something in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. And it took, you know, a long time and a lot of effort to kind of build, I can't claim consensus because not everyone agreed with the outcome, but build, you know, broad support for that as the outcome in a way that was, you know, being responsive to lots of different needs. And that's the reality when you are working for the public, is like, you're working for everybody. So you have to balance all of those needs. And we have a limited amount of space for streets, for parking, for sidewalks, and figuring out how we can best use that space means there are going to be trade-offs. And that's something, you know, you have to be able to work through and come to some kind of outcome that hopefully serves the most people in the best way.
Well, my experience of the times that I've worked for city government is that when the people care a lot, they sometimes come to public meetings and say exactly how they feel, but not necessarily in a nice way. You don't have to acknowledge that that's happened to you, but when that does happen, how do you care for yourself afterwards? What are the kinds of things that you do to, like, because you can't go back and yell back at the public. You have to sort of, as a city servant, like, be like, we're writing down your feedback and taking a survey. Like, what are the things that you do to kind of right yourself in the midst of some of those difficult conversations?
I think my real answer is that too often in politics, we treat people who do not agree with us as, like, not even people, right? And so much of the motivation, almost all of the incentives in, like, electoral politics, for instance, are to just, like, demonize and dehumanize, you know, your opponents. And especially when you're, you know, working in government and it's not about opposition, it's about serving the public. But also, I think in all of political life, all of civic life, we are better off when we see everyone for who they are and see everyone as people who have needs and have desires, and that their needs and desires are important, even if you don't agree with them or share them. And I think that was an important just sort of coping mechanism for me. If somebody's yelling at you, was just to really get to a point where, like, hey, I see you, I hear you, I mean that sincerely, and I understand that you are angry, and I want to understand where that's coming from. And I know it's not about me, right? It's about your life or your needs or whatever. And so for me, just trying to come to a point of understanding, of meeting people where they're at and understanding where they're coming from, and knowing it's not about me, was really helpful for being able to get through, you know, those experiences and that job with my self-esteem intact. 'Cause it's hard. Working for the public is hard. And I think people, you know, in government and people in politics take a lot of heat. It sort of comes with the territory. But what I'm always interested in is making sure that we are seeing people for the fullness of their human experience, even and especially when we disagree with them.
Does it become harder than if the conversation people are trying to have in those forums are more closely related to you? Because I know that you've lived through times where marriage was not allowed for LGBTQ people. You've lived through a lot of weird laws that have been proposed. You've gone to a lot of rallies for unjust laws that are affecting members of your personal family and your chosen family, and it becomes personal. How do you stay well in the midst of people picking intentional fights against the idea of you? Like, I don't think anyone's sat down and been like, we're going to make sure Edward really gets screwed here. But there are people writing laws about the idea of you, right? Of their idea of what people like you are.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I have gotten probably more than my fair share of death threats. So it's hard to, you know, get more personal than that. But still, like, even if someone is wishing death upon me, it's probably not about me. It's about ways in which they've been conditioned or they've been harmed and led to believe and tricked into believing that my joy or my well-being or my cause is a threat to them, when, you know, it isn't, unless what you feel threatened by is other people doing well. And if you think your joy comes from putting other people down, yeah, I am a threat to you. But I mean, just in general, I think ways that I try to take care of myself or, you know, feel recharged or feel refreshed, always involve trying to get outside of my ego. And you know, like that comes up immediately when anyone talks about like meditation or like yoga practices. Those are things I try to practice, but those are also like really inward facing. But I think it also comes up in things that are really kind of outward facing, or totally outside of myself. Like there is nothing as effective at immediately bringing me back to the moment, bringing me back to my body, making me feel present than my dog. I mean that so seriously. Like she forces me to just focus on what is right in front of me. And I think we spend so much of our lives like fixated on these outside things, these like massive external forces that are so much bigger than us, the next election or capitalism or the economy or like street conditions, like whatever, climate crisis. There's just such an immense amount of things to be anxious about. And I think with like the internet and smartphones and like social media, we are confronted with the things that make us anxious literally all of the time. So with my dog, I have developed this, like, it's like an almost like a mantra where if like X thing is stressing me out, I will just like hold her and look into her eyes and say, you don't even know what that thing is. You don't even know what an election is. You don't even know what a president or a mayor or whatever is. And yet she has a whole interior life and emotions, and those are valid and valuable, and she doesn't need any of those other things. And so she just brings me back to like where I am and who I am and when I am. And I don't mean that to say that those big things don't matter. They absolutely do. It's just that they're not the only things that matter. And I think oftentimes the anxiety that we feel about those big external forces isn't even necessarily motivating or helpful. It can just be debilitating, and like having that kind of reminder is important. But you know, I think getting outside my ego, getting outside myself, also comes through experiences that I call sublime. Sometimes I feel that in nature, or at a march or a direct action or a sit-in or a protest or looking at the ocean or a painting or going to a concert. And sometimes I just feel it in the connections that we have. For me, that's primarily with my husband, but also in community, in social groups, social movements, with family. Yeah. So those are the primary ways I try to stay well.
Well, and I haven't heard if you identify this way yet, but my guess, just from observing you and being at several, in the same spaces with you, is that you are a person who also knows how to deploy fabulousness for good. And by what I mean by that is like, I feel like I've been in spaces where like your outfit was everything enough that it was doing all the wellness work. I don't know if this is a direct quote from you, but I feel like I've had this sort of conversation where you're just like, I'm here and my outfit is doing the rest. Like,
oh, there is a phrase that I use, which is, when I feel my worst, I look my best, which is sincere. if I'm having a really bad day, I want to put on a really great outfit. and I don't know. I think it just goes back to the sense of like joy. Right. And I think so often in like movement work and organizing spaces, we refer to things as a struggle. And that's real. That is a real reflection of what it is like to fight for and win rights and causes. And still, I think it's so important to like make space for joy. And there's a really great book called Pleasure Activism that looks at like how can we make activism the most pleasurable thing we can do. Like these things that feel really hard and really difficult and often are, how can we try to do it in such a way that it's actually joyful? It actually makes us feel more human and more like ourselves. So that is something I try to embody. It's a practice, you know. it's not something I am perfect at or get right all the time, or probably even most of the time, but like that is something I believe in and try to do.
Well, I think there's something, I feel like I've heard this from the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. It may be Joy for sure has said this to me. And I feel like it's something like, if people are going to try to harm us in clubs or in dance spaces, then the way we live in retaliation to those kinds of existential threats and real physical dangers as queer people is to dance and to like, or as maybe Joy would say it, to embrace the thumpa thumpa music, right? And so I think that's part of it is like, you know, if I've been there on days I get death threats, I'm a like, where my most fabulousness, not because of vanity, although I guess it is a little, but because for me, it's about, I always pick things that are in bloom. So I'll pick flowers that are in bloom so that when someone's threatening me to like take away my sunshine or to take away my spark, that my outfit's going to be blooming to remind me that I'm alive in the midst of whatever the nonsense is that's happening. And I mean, I see you living that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, the night that Trump got elected in 2016, after it was called, I went out dancing with a bunch of friends. We were at what was supposed to be, a victory party for Hillary Clinton. And we were all just sitting around. It was all queer people. We're all just sitting around, you know, being like, oh my God, what is happening? Like, what's going to happen next? And we're like, well, we don't know. Right now, we can go dance. And that is an action we can take right now that felt like it was a form of resistance. And that feels weird. But it's also real. And I think, you know, making space for queer joy is an act of resistance. And I remain committed to that, even and especially, you know, in the most tragic or awful circumstances. Yeah.
Well, and it's something I think everyone should experience at least once in their life, regardless of how they identify and their background. Is if you are nervous about a political election, no matter what happens that night, go to the Castro in San Francisco. Because there will be people to dance with you. There will be people to cry with you. There will be people on every side of an issue because there are queer people on every side of issues. But there is something about being in community and being in a community with people who have been through enough that they know that this isn't going to defeat them. And so there. Wherever you are, if you are nervous about an election and you're going to be nice to the people in the Castro, come to the Castro after an election because it is its own encounter. I remember being there the night when Obama was elected for the first time. However, Prop 8 also passed, which was a law here in California to say that LGBTQ people would not be allowed to be married. And it got overturned later. But being that night with people sitting in the streets in the middle of the Castro, while you could hear people publicly yelling out their windows that they were excited about one part of the election and the whole nother community was just weeping. And so there's something about sitting in collectivity with people and then in joy and or in pain, dancing it out, whichever way it needs to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's something the Castro does well, but I think a lot of communities do it, right? And whether you're mourning, whether you're celebrating, it feels good to feel things together. Bell Hooks has a quote that I'd like to offer, which is, rarely, if ever, are we healed in isolation. Healing is an act of communion. And I that has been so true for me in my own life. And I push back a lot on like hashtag self-care culture because I feel like so much of it is like commercialized and individualized and prioritizing, you know, we're all these little bubbles and we just need to focus on our interior life and ignore the things around us. And it's like, well, no, we live in community, we live in systems, we live in a culture, and oftentimes the best way to take care of yourself is to dig deeper and connect more with more people.
I definitely see that in a lot of the ways that you kind of identified yourself in kind of the opening here, is like being a part of a union is a collective act of hope, right? It's not just what you have now, but what you're going to gain together by staying together in the future. And casting a vote is an act of hope, right? That things can be better, and that your active voting matters and is counted. And there are so many ways in which you are sort of an embodiment of continuing to cast your hope into the world, kind of whatever happens. I'm just so grateful that you exist, that you are fighting for things, and that you're out there in the world.
Well, thank you. I feel the same for you. Absolutely. And hope has been kind of the animating force of my life. And that's true from, you know, my first job in politics was working for Cleve Jones. For folks who don't know, Cleve was a protege of Harvey Milk and created the AIDS Memorial Quilt, the NAMES Project, and the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and did a lot of work around marriage equality and also a lot of union organizing. And what I learned from him was just, I mean, many things, but one of them is just like the primacy of hope and like how important that is. And like, it can sound trite, it can sound cliche, but it is so true. and Rebecca Solnit, who's a San Franciscan, an amazing writer. If you're listening to this and like the things we're talking about and you have not read her work, I would highly recommend it. She's written a lot about hope and the idea that it's an action you take in an emergency. Like it's not a passive thing. It's not you sitting around waiting for a better outcome. It's the thing that gets you out the door. And it's about like, to be hopeful is to give yourself to the future, and work towards that in the present. And I just find the way she thinks and talks about it so compelling and motivating and beautiful.
Well, I'm gonna go and read that for sure. And I've also I've decided that anytime I actually do leave my house to go to the party I thought I would go to, I'm gonna decide that that's an act of hope from now on. Of like, the struggle is real, right? If people are interested in connecting with you more, what's the best way to do that?
Well, one of my ways of self-care is trying to not be too active on social media, but I am on Instagram. You can find me there. It's Edward Wright SF. So just first name, last name, SF. And that is also my handle on various other social platforms that I use much less. Folks can also email me if they want. Edward Wright mail, mail at gmail.com.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our conversation. I am so glad that you did. Your support really helps to make conversations like these possible. If you have a moment to like and subscribe, that would be fantastic. And if you don't, well, that's okay too. My hope is that these conversations help you to make it through another day and live as the work in progress that you are. If you found a little bit of inspiration, I hope you'll come back and listen to more episodes in the future. Thanks again.